Okay, yes. So I'm going to be talking about what we can learn about supermassive black hole binaries with pulsar timing arrays. So the title of my talk in the program is Astrophysics with Pulsar Timing Arrays, which I always think is kind of interesting because literally everything we do is astrophysics because the pulsars themselves are compact objects and the pulses propagate through the interstellar medium. And so every stage of our experiment is more astrophysics. But just to keep it sort of contained, I'm going to focus on the gravitational wave sources themselves and not the astrophysics of the pulsars. Although I'm going to talk a little bit about non-black hole related astrophysics towards the end. Okay, so here we are, pulsar timing arrays. We are at the very low frequencies, order of nanohertz. And so we really are complementary to LIGO and LISA, helping to fill out the gravitational wave spectrum. And as Megan said, our primary sources are supermassive black hole binaries. Right? So we believe that supermassive black hole binaries will form when two massive galaxies merge. Their individual black holes will form a binary. They'll be brought together through some kind of environmental process. Eventually, gravitational wave radiation will take over as the dominant mechanism causing the orbital evolution. This is the regime where they are emitting in the PTA band. And then eventually they will merge and they will form an even more supermassive black hole. And this is the part that LISA is sensitive to. PTAs cannot see the merger itself. Actually, I should say, PTAs can't see the oscillatory part of the merger. They are sensitive to the gravitational wave memory. So, yeah, this plot does have it. You can see this, the waveform, there's this little offset at the end. That's the memory effect. It's a few percent of the energy is carried away in the memory. But yes, PTAs can basically see this memory effect and then this part out here. Now, when they're in the PTA band, they are not evolving very much over the timescale of our experiment unless they have really high chirp masses. And so we call them continuous waves, although we do include the orbital evolution in our signal models. Yep. Right, so this is a plot from Joe Simon showing the gravitational wave emission from a simulated population of supermassive black hole binaries. Each of these points is a different source, its amplitude, its strain amplitude and frequency. And then the sum of all of them is the stochastic background shown by this solid black line. And so you can see the stochastic background is significantly louder than any of the individual sources. And that's why we expect that the first source we will detect is the stochastic background. And then eventually we will start to see the loudest sources in each of these frequency bins. And you might notice that this high frequency end, the curve is not so straight, it's sort of raggedy looking. That's because at the high frequency end, the stochasticity kind of breaks down because you just don't have that many sources contributing. But the strain amplitudes are so much lower here, we don't expect to detect this part of the curve right away. Also, as you'll see later, our sensitivity sort of makes a V shape. So our sensitivity is much higher at the high frequency, our sensitivity is much worse at the high frequencies. Okay, now, but of course for PTAs, it's not just about detecting the stochastic background. We want to characterize it and use it to study the population of supermassive black hole binaries. So you can learn a lot from the different properties of the background. So first of all, if you assume that the background is just made up of circular binaries that evolve solely due to gravitational wave emission, then the characteristic strain should follow this F to the minus 2/3 power law. And the amplitude here, the amplitude encodes things like the merger time scale, the supermassive black hole mass distribution, right? And it kind of shifts it up and down in amplitude. And then this F to the minus 2/3, that comes from the mechanism that's causing the binaries to evolve. So if it's gravitational wave emission, it's going to be F to the minus 2/3. If, however, at low frequencies, the evolution is dominated by environmental effects, the slope is going to be different. And so where you go from environmentally driven to gravitational wave driven, there's going to be this turnover, which is shown here, right? Okay, so these are sort of the main things that we're trying to measure. Three things: the amplitude of the spectrum, the slope, and then whether or not there is a turnover, and if so, how much it turns over and where. Okay, so as I'm sure you're all aware, we have not yet detected gravitational waves with PTAs. I actually really enjoyed the talk earlier about talking about sort of the history of LIGO, putting out all these papers with limits on mergers of binary neutron stars. You know, we're still in that limits stage of our collaboration. So these are the most recent limits on the stochastic background. They come from an analysis of the NanoGrav 11-year data set. The straight black line here is if you assume that F to the minus 2/3 power law. And then the V-shaped curve is if you place an upper limit on a characteristic strain at each frequency independently. So you can see it kind of cuts off at low frequencies. This is set by the total observation time, or 1 over the total observation time. And then it slopes up here. Right here, you're dominated by white noise in your detector. There's this big spike at a frequency of 1 over a year. That comes from the fact that we have to fit the pulsar's positions, right? And the Earth is moving at the period of a year, so we can't detect gravitational waves there. Now, these three colored bands depict three different models for the stochastic background, which are helpfully labeled optimistic, moderate, and pessimistic. You can see that our limits are now probing into the moderate part of parameter space. So we are making astrophysically interesting, or we're placing astrophysically interesting limits on the stochastic background. Right. Now, over on the right, this is a different approach to looking for the stochastic background. This one is really looking at the the power spectrum of any common red process. Over here, we're looking for we're specifically looking for these cross correlations between two different pulsars that Megan talked about, this Hellings and Downs curve. So the cross correlation between two different pulsars should just be a function of their angular separation. And so in the top, I'm plotting the cross-correlated power as a function of angular separation. It's binned into 10-degree angles. And the red dashed line is the Hellings and Downs curve. And yeah, I mean, these error bars are so huge, right? I mean, it's definitely consistent with zero. So this is just really showing you that we don't yet have evidence for the cross-correlations, although if I had shown you the error bars from the 9-year data set, you'd be really impressed at how much smaller they are in this one. Down here, this is a histogram of the number of pulsar pairs as a function of angular separation, just to kind of demonstrate where we are sensitive, right? Because in order to really characterize this curve, we need to be able to measure it at multiple angular separations. Now, right now, we are most sensitive in this range, say 30 to 60 degrees. We don't have a lot of pairs at really large angular separation from one another. So this gets into what Megan was talking about with adding new pulsars to your array. This whole analysis uses a total of 34 pulsars. This is not the same number that are in the 11-year data set, because we only use them for gravitational wave analyses once they have at least 3 years of data. And that's because we want at least a few years to be able to really pin down all of those timing parameters, the astrometric parameters. For example, you need at least a couple of, you know, orbits around the sun to get a handle on them. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about how we can take these limits on the gravitational wave strain and turn those into statements about astrophysics, right? So over on the left, I'm showing the relationship between the bulge mass and the black hole mass for a number of different galaxies, right? And the slope here is this alpha parameter, right? This is from a McConnell and Moss paper. And then over on the right, I'm showing our constraints on alpha, on the slope of this curve, based on our limits on the amplitude of the stochastic background, right? And then for reference, there are a few models here. Right? You can do something a little more sophisticated, though, if you, you can do something a little bit more sophisticated, though, and look at a bunch of different astrophysical properties at once. Using a Gaussian process. So this is from a paper by Steve Taylor, Joe Simon, and Laura Sampson, where they trained a Gaussian process on simulations of the stochastic background, and then they used that Gaussian process to perform astrophysical inference based on PTA limits. Right? We applied this in the 11-year data set to get constraints on things like the density and the eccentricity and the and alpha. This is just an excerpt from one of the figures in our paper. There's actually 6 panels. I only showed 3 of them. This is just sort of a sample of the kind of thing that we can do. Okay, another thing that you can do is constrain supermassive black hole binary candidates. There are a number of candidates these days from various sources. So this is from a paper by Miguel Holgado, Alberto Sassana, and others, where they took a look at the at some of these quasi-periodic BLAC objects from Fermi, and they showed that if these quasi-periodic objects are all binaries, that would mean that the stochastic background is way louder than the limits placed by PTAs. And so from that, they put constraints on the binary fraction of those candidates. Okay, kind of shifting gears a little bit, another thing you can do with PTAs is look for alternative polarizations. So in general relativity, there are only 2 polarizations of gravitational waves that propagate, the plus and the cross. But in other theories of gravity, there can be additional modes. In general, any tensor theory of gravity, there are 6 modes. So there's the plus and the cross, there's a breathing mode, and then there's some scalar and vector longitudinal modes. Pulsar timing arrays are particularly well suited for this kind of test because, in essence, we have all these different, you know, lines of sight between the Earth and all of our different pulsars. And so you can put very good constraints on the polarization. So if you have alternative polarizations, the cross-correlation isn't going to be the Hellings-and-Downs curve, which is shown in blue. It's going to have some other shape, and you can go out and look for those. Okay, now I want to shift gears and talk about individual sources. So as I said, we expect to detect the stochastic background first, and then we will be detecting individual binaries. Right, so there's a degeneracy between the chert mass and the luminosity distance. Both of them appear in the gravitational wave strain, like so. But you are able to separate these out if you can measure separately the Earth term and the pulsar term. So the way that gravitational waves affect the residuals, they depends upon what the gravitational wave is doing at the pulsar and at the Earth. And if we think about each Earth, this is the Earth. If we think about the Earth-pulsar pairs, right, the Earth is always the same and the pulsars are different. Not only are they at different points in the sky, they're at different positions in space, and they're probing the gravitational wave at different times in the binary's evolution. So when we're thinking about the stochastic background, we just ignore the pulsar terms, we only worry about the Earth term. But if you have a continuous, if you have a single source, and you know its direction, and you know the distances to all of your pulsars, then you can calculate how much the frequency has evolved between that pulsar and the Earth, right? So you can actually calculate what all the pulsar terms should be. Now there's a really important complication here that we don't know the distances to most of our pulsars to within a gravitational wavelength. So you have to marginalize over that in your analysis. But you know, in principle, you can figure out the difference in gravitational wave frequency at the Earth compared to the pulsars, and then that difference will tell you the chert mass. Okay, so this is from our recent paper placing limits on gravitational waves from individual supermassive black hole binaries. These limits are placed searching over the entire sky. For comparison, here's the 11-year data set, and then 9 years and 5 years, so you can see how much improvement there is as we go to longer data sets. The big difference, though, between the 9-year and the 11-year is the number of pulsars. The 9-year data set, that analysis only uses 18, and for the 11-year, there are 34. Okay, now, it's not surprising that we didn't detect any gravitational waves with our analysis of the 11-year data set. And we compared our upper limits to simulated populations of supermassive black hole binaries. This is from a simulation by Chiara Mingarelli. So these are some simulated binaries. These are our upper limits. You can see we're well above, except there is this one that's sort of tantalizingly high. Right here I'm plotting the sky averaged upper limit and then also the upper limit at the most sensitive sky location, which you can see is significantly better. I do want to say that this realization is the one that's in the paper, and it's chosen because it has this, yeah, has this one really optimistic source. But no, we also just, we counted up the total number of realizations, and I think it was like 34 out of 75,000, so odds are not very good. Thanks. Okay, so we can also place limits as a function of the sky location. So here, this is for a fixed gravitational wave frequency of 8 nanohertz, and it's showing the sensitivity across the sky. Here the sensitivity is cast in terms of the distance to any potential binaries, right? So at our most sensitive sky location, we can look out to 120 megaparsecs for a chert mass of 10 to the 9. But at our least sensitive sky location, which is about here, we can only look out to 18. And that's because of the distribution of pulsars. Most of our pulsars are over here, and then unfortunately most of the candidates are over here. And so again, as Megan was talking about, this is a big motivating factor for why we're doing all of these surveys. Now, these stars are only the pulsars that have at least 3 years of data as of the 11-year data set. So there are more stars for the 12.5-year data set, and it will fill out this portion of the sky better. Okay. Another thing we did in the paper as a proof of principle, more than anything else, was we looked specifically at the Virgo cluster, and we know the distance to the Virgo cluster, so we cast our limits in terms of limits on the chert mass of any potential binaries, and we're able to put some pretty good limits, especially at higher frequencies, right? So one of our ongoing projects is to place constraints on the chert masses of many massive galaxies within the local universe. Okay, and then the last thing I want to talk about, which is astrophysics, but is not related to compact objects, is the solar system barycenter, right? So as Megan said, you have to reference pulsar timing to an inertial reference frame, and we use the solar system barycenter. And in the past, we always treated this as something that could be done exactly. JPL would give us this ephemeris, and we would put it into our timing model. We'd calculate where the barycenter is. Well, when we were analyzing the 11-year data set, we got this really unpleasant surprise that when you used some of the recent ephemerides, you got very different posteriors on the stochastic background, or I should say on any common red process, right? So DE-435, definitely nothing. DE-430, it's kind of tantalizing, right? So what's going on? Well, the stochastic background doesn't care about the choice of ephemeris. It's because of ephemeris error. And so we now marginalize over uncertainty in the position of Jupiter when we do our gravitational wave analyses. When we use this model, which we call Bayes-FM, you get the same posterior regardless of what ephemeris you use, and all of the uncertainty is absorbed into these Bayes-FM parameters. Right. Okay, so I'll just end there, leave my conclusions up. Thank you.
Thank you for the great talk. So, questions?
Hi. You mentioned that PTAs could constrain alternative polarizations of gravitational waves. Could you give us a sense of how they do that? Who's likely to do that first or to do that better?
Compared to like LIGO?
Yeah.
Right, so LIGO has this L shape, and if you just have a single L-shaped detector, you can't detect the breathing mode at all. We don't have that problem. We are sensitive to all polarizations. I'm only somewhat familiar with LIGO's work in alternative polarizations. I know that they have a bunch of papers about them for individual sources as well as the stochastic background. And there are things that they can do to take advantage of the fact that the detector is, moving through space. But, bottom line, you have like an L-shaped detector and you only have, you have three of them. And we have, dozens of pulsars spread all over the sky. So our constraints are our ability to differentiate between different polarizations, I think, is quite good. Yeah.
Okay, I guess I really meant next few years of ground-based rather than just current LIGO, because obviously having different...
Oh, I see.
But maybe that doesn't change your answer.
I suppose it really depends on when we actually make a positive detection of gravitational waves, right? Because at this point, we do put limits on alternative polarizations, but, everything we do is placing limits. I guess I'll say that if we have an individual source and it happens to be really close to a pulsar, we can put really strong constraints on, I'm blanking on one of the modes, but basically one of the modes has a really strong, a really sharply peaked antenna pattern. So if you happen to have a pulsar lined up near it, you can put really, really good constraints on that polarization.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Other questions?
So I guess in the pictures, people usually show the Hellings and Downs curve with some error bars on it, but that's probably not the correct way to make best use of the data. So can you say a little bit about what's actually done?
Yes, absolutely. So we have, two sort of parallel approaches, one Bayesian, one frequentist. So this one is the frequentist one. It uses the optimal statistic, and there we actually are just fitting the cross-correlated power to the Hellings and Downs curve and seeing how good the fit is. For the Bayesian analysis, we do it in different stages. We look for a common red process. We look for a common red process with the Hellings and Downs spatial correlations. We compare the Bayes factors between the two. We also we fix the spectral index. We let it vary, all so that we can say very rigorously, these are the features that we are seeing. These are the features that we don't yet have evidence for. And based on our simulations, what we expect is that initially what you'll just see is a common red process. So basically what you're seeing is the extra red noise in each individual pulsar from the stochastic background. And that it has this, it follows the same power law for all of them. But you won't be able to see the cross correlations at first, right? And so initially your Bayes factor for common red process would be high, but, Hellings and Downs correlations would be kind of meh. And then gradually the significance of the correlations will grow.
I have one question about this plot that you have right here, and one that I guess it's probably meant for Alberto. So how long do you think that we would have to wait until we can actually reach sensitivity down to the level of where we might be starting to worry about the pessimistic results here?
I'm not sure whether your question is more about like our ability to get down to this region or like how pessimistic the models
No, it's essentially how long does it take until the sensitivity becomes significant to the level that we can test these lower amplitudes, essentially at 10 to the minus, a few times 10 to the minus 15.
Yes, yes, okay, yes. So, right, so we're in the process of doing a lot of simulation work because of the decadal. And in those simulations, we make some pretty, I would say, modest assumptions about like adding 4 new pulsars per year. And based on those simulations, we can get down to this, you know, bottom region within the next 10 years.
Yeah. Okay.
And that does not take into account the IPTA. So this is just, you know, timing the pulsars that we can see with nanograv telescopes. Okay. So with the IPTA, we would do better.
And the other question has to do with a plot that you showed about setting constraints of the existing number of candidate BLACs.
Yes, that's, well, that's...
Yeah, Alberta's. That's why I said that it's yes. Probably a question mainly for Alberto. So I wasn't able to actually read through the plots. What's the fraction that is now allowed, essentially? So, I don't know.
The binary well, maybe Alberto can comment.
No, well, there is a... So there's a number of BLACs that show, you know, tantalizing wiggles. And in the brightest ones, if you take the 50 brightest BLACs, it's in 10% of them. So you have like 5 candidates out of 50. And then what we do here is like, you know, if you have like more than 10 to the minus 3, if you have more than one BLAC in 10 to the minus 3, that is an actual binary, you already overproduce the signal that you would see with PTA. So those things that, you know, you, as you might expect, they are probably just some red noise stuff or some wiggling of jets or whatever. They're not. They're not. Very likely they're not due to binaries.
Yeah, this is a follow-up on the previous question. You were saying that you're more likely to see a common red process
yes.
than correlation. So
well, no, first we'll just see like the power from the stochastic background, but we won't be able to see or the evidence that the power is actually correlated between two different pulsars and that it has the correct angular dependence. That will come later.
But if you just see the power, how do you know it's not just the pulsars that are more noisy? I mean, don't you absolutely need the correlations to be able to establish for sure it's a gravitational wave background?
Absolutely, and that's why we do this in like multiple stages so that we can kind of track how the significance of the background is growing. I mean, when we saw the ephemeris error, that also showed up as a common red process, but it had no evidence of the Hellings and Downs correlations, and then eventually we were able to track it down to being caused by the ephemeris. So yeah, absolutely. You know,
so detection does need the correlation. Like
yes.
It absolutely needs the Hellings and Downs curves and correlation.
Yes.
Right?
Okay. Yes. That's why that's part of why we always use these two different approaches. The optimal statistic specifically targets these spatial correlations. So you can always compare like what these results are telling you and then be really confident about what features of the stochastic background you're actually seeing.
I have a question.
Second slide, right, is dependent. Upper limit 2% from the amplitude.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Concerning the eccentricity, so we know that probably in the range of PTA, the binaries have high eccentricity because it is always excited either by stellar or gas dynamical processes. So what is the mean eccentricity that really can cause this bending of the shape of the intensity of the background?
Oh, I do not know that. Sorry.
Strongly coupled with the density, but yeah. But we can talk about that later.
Okay. Other?
Oh, Alberta has.
I have a question. So if I look at the plot of the correlation there.
Yes.
It looks like you have the most weighted angular power, discriminating power, exactly where the Hellings and Downs curve crosses zero.
Yes, that is
true.
Which
is unfortunate. I mean,
it's actually because of a single pair. It's the 1713-1909 pair. Those are our two best pulsars. And their angular separation just happens to mean that it should cross zero. Yes, it's just a... Yeah, it's just the way that it is. Yeah.
So are considerations like this taken into account when, you know, adding new pulsars, you know, or we are still at the stage where, okay, whatever we can add, we add, because we just need to add pulsars.
No, we're absolutely thinking about that. So so Megan and others had a proposal based around trying to fill out the Hellings and Downs curve. You know, we have so few pairs at the large angular separations. You would really like to be able to pin down this part of the curve better. Yeah. I mean, it's still the case that if we find a good pulsar, you know, we add it. But we are starting to think about, okay, where are the pulsars that would help us the most?
Well, if there are no further questions, thanks again. And the session is over, so let me take the liberty to really thank the organizers for this wonderful meeting.